We're speaking with Megan Burke, who's an associate professor of sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University and the author of the book Colorblind Racism. She's going to be speaking about the paradox of colorblind racism at Western Michigan University on February 13th. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Perhaps we should start out with some definitions. What do you mean by the phrase colorblind racism?
Yeah, great question. And again, as the title of my talk at Western indicates, the title is sort of paradoxical, right? Because I think most people hear colorblind and think that that must be a good thing, and then hear racism. And of course, most folks, I think, rightly consider that a bad thing. So when I talk about, and other scholars talk about, colorblind racism, what we're talking about are ways of talking and thinking about race that do a few things. One is that it tends to affirm our belief in individualism. And so we give credit or blame to the individual and his or her talents or their effort in order to explain differing racial outcomes. Another thing that colorblind racism tends to do is that it will emphasize what I say are these often imagined cultural differences. And of course, that doesn't mean that there's no such thing as culture, but what it does mean is that we give culture too much explanatory power. So we give culture too much credit in either being able to help us understand why we might see differential racial outcomes. And what both of those things do together is that they tend to help us not pay careful attention to the ways that racism does still operate in our society, the many remaining barriers to equality, the legacy of the past, as it impacts the present in terms of folks' opportunities, as well as the ongoing realities of racism that we still unfortunately face today. So all of that taken together is what we mean by colorblind racism.
Do you think that from the point of view of people who are not people of color, that there's an attitude of, well, you know, racism is in the past and we've overcome that, and so now it's, you know, it's basically all on you if you're not doing well?
That's exactly right. And that's really another great way to express what colorblind racism is. And folks may not be intending to uphold racist ideologies or practices when they think that way. They often think that way because of what they have and also what they haven't learned about the ways that racism really operates in our society. And so, that's a very common way that folks come to understand racism. But as a sociologist and a social scientist, we are able to demonstrate how that's actually a flawed understanding, and we can improve what some will call our racial literacy by being instead able and willing to analyze and acknowledge and act around the ways that racism and race does still operate in our lives and in our opportunity structures.
You know, there's another concept, institutional racism, as opposed to personal racism. You know, personal racism is you act in a racist way towards another individual. And that's usually fairly obvious, but institutional racism, not so much. That is playing into this, I assume.
Absolutely. And so one of the ways that I think we can think through that together is making the distinction, just as you have, between individual prejudice and bias, which often in, you know, everyday life we will call personal racism, and that's fair enough. But if we understand racism as really a system of advantage or disadvantage that shapes the outcomes and the opportunities for people, all of us, dependent on our race, then we're more into that territory of institutional racism. And that's understandably harder for folks to see. And yet the evidence is clear that that is something that does still persist. And that's really what we have to be able to grapple with. So colorblind racism says, no, that's not a thing. That's not there. It, you know, if I'm a good person and if I don't, you know, do anything intentionally that's harmful, then I must not be part of a racist society or contributing to unfair and really undesired, often, racial outcomes. But if we think a little bit more carefully, I think that we're able to see how that is the case, and then to try to think about ways that we might act in a way that's better aligned with our intentions and our goals.
And, you know, there's another, in the minds of some people, fraught concept of white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also in the mix, too.
Absolutely. And I think that that's really, again, one of those things that's hard to see if you haven't been taught to see it. And it can be hard to recognize if you're someone like me, as a white person who does benefit in ways that I haven't earned from the reality of my whiteness. And I really am hopeful that we, and you know, this is part of the work that I like to do when I come and give talks. It's part of the hope when I, if people read my books, that they might be able to come away with it. When I do teaching with my students, you know, for us to be able to recognize privilege, I mean, it's a description and not a condemnation, right? And I think that the better that we can get comfortable with just understanding that reality, and then thinking about how we can be thoughtful allies in work for racial and social equity, that's not really something that we have to be as anxious about as I think too many white folks unfortunately are.
I'd like to ask you about some concrete effects of color blindness when it comes to racial issues, one of which is affirmative action, particularly at the university level. There have been a lot of controversies in various places, including here in Michigan, over admission policies to, you know, should race be considered in admitting a student to a college or university? And, you know, a lot of people, mostly not people of color, say that it should not be considered. And I am going to assume that you would consider that an example of what we're talking about.
Well, I mean, I think that people can have a whole range of policy beliefs that come from different places. So I'm not willing to go as far to say that if you oppose affirmative action, that it's definitely part of colorblind racism. However, I do know, both from teaching and working with people and having these conversations, as well as, you know, there's been a variety of research studies that have explored people's attitudes toward affirmative action. And those point to a couple things. One is that I think that it still tends to be widely misunderstood. And so I think people tend to have the perception that race is solely or significantly determinative in college admissions decisions. And I actually teach about those U of M cases when I work with my students and able to, in order to help them see how the courts parsed that, right? And in both cases, race could not be a heavily significant variable, but in some cases it could be part of those kinds of considerations. And that happens for a whole host of other reasons. That happens alongside other kinds of considerations that are perhaps just as either subjective or the kinds of things that folks don't have any control over, like legacy admissions come to mind, that people don't tend to get as upset about. And so I do think that those perceptions can stem from and contribute to things like racial resentment. And again, when we're into that landscape, again, I think we have to have a wider, more accurate and more complex understanding of how any social system works. And certainly that's true for things like college admissions.
What are some of the other areas that are affected by this?
Yeah, you know, gosh, of course, I wrote a whole book about it, so I'm tempted to say, well, what isn't? I do think that it is infused in the kinds of conversations that we have, and then that also shows up in the work that we do. And so all of my research looks at how people who are embedded in various kinds of social activities, so they're influential in various ways, whether it's in their communities, in their neighborhoods, how they're really utilizing what they think they know about race and racism, and looking at the real impact that that has. And in fact, I've studied folks across the political spectrum, both in progressive communities in Chicago, that are racially diverse and people are really proud and excited that they're racially diverse and hold a liberal or progressive political identity, and they enact colorblind racism in a variety of complex ways, either by drawing on various racial codes, projecting themselves as a non-racist, and yet doing work that continues to uphold their interests in the neighborhood at the expense often of people of color, as well as folks on the far right, who are involved in political activity that is hopeful to enact policies that would also have caused racial harm, right, including things like racial profiling and a whole host of other kinds of measures. And so I think that, you know, it's pervasive. It's pervasive in our everyday life. It's pervasive across the political spectrum. And really, they all point to ways that we are focusing perhaps too much on ourselves and whether or not we're good or bad people, rather than focusing on the way that our institutions are put together and looking carefully at the kinds of things that might give us better outcomes. Because most people don't want racial inequality, and most people don't want unfairness. And yet, when we fail to have a lens that helps us analyze how racism really works in often insidious and covert ways in contemporary society, then we're not able to do that work.
One of the areas you've talked about elsewhere is healthcare and the very wide disparity in outcomes, in the healthcare system for people who are white and those who are not. So is colorblind racism at play there too?
I think that it is. You know, my book really canvasses some research that others have done in that area. So healthcare is not my area of scholarly expertise, but you do see indicators that, for example, healthcare professionals may perceive that that people of color are less are able to tolerate more pain, for example, and so may not believe folks when they're talking about significant issues that they're having with their bodies, and then therefore may be less poised to help. There is, of course, incredible issues of access to decent health care, whether through its insurance coverage or a whole host of other mechanisms. And so sociologists look at things like social determinants of health as well that get us into that landscape of structural and institutional racism that sits alongside the biases, again, that we all learn and that we all have. It's hard not to have internalized some of them. It's just the degree to which we may be conscious of those biases and really work to assure that they are not impacting, in this case, the care that we provide to others.
And what about another hot button issue, law enforcement?
Sure. Yeah. What can I say? You know, I think that there's really no area of life that is not touched by the racial biases and the racial stereotypes that, again, are pervasive in our media system, in our political system. I think that I understand why folks are sensitive, because police officers are engaging in what is sometimes some very dangerous work, and they deserve credit for doing that. But, you know, in response, I'll say, you know, all folks are really saying is that law enforcement officials are human beings, you know, and human beings living in a society where racism is still salient. In fact, there's research that shows that police of color sometimes, perhaps through a variety of different pressures, are enacting some of the same racial biases, right? And so being able to hold that truth and to think around it, and I know that many police officers are trying very hard to do some careful work in this area, but it remains true everywhere that much more work still needs to be done to start from the question of how and in what ways racism is operating in any context, rather than trying to wiggle out from under it and say, no, there's no racism here. I think that that's a far less tenable position, and it would be much healthier for us to ask how rather than if racism is operating.
The title of your talk here at Western is The Paradox of Colorblind Racism, the paradox being that instead of furthering racial equality, it actually makes it worse.
Yeah, that's part of the paradox. The paradox is also just kind of built into the title of colorblindness, right? Because most folks pick up on what is a noble sentiment, right? I think that some of this, as others have pointed out before me, you know, comes even from, King and his comments. We tend to listen to the last third of the I Have a Dream speech, where he rightly focuses on his hope that his children will be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. And, you know, most people support that as a noble ideal. And in fact, there's growing bodies of research that are looking at colorblind identities and colorblind ideals and folks that are really trying to live up to that dream. However, that is far from the reality, unfortunately. And so the paradox is also in that in order to really be able to handle the very real problems that we have with racism in our society, we really have to start again from that question of how race still matters and in what ways racism is still at play, rather than saying, no, I don't see race, because that's just not reasonable.
A hard question, I admit. So it's a problem. How do we get beyond it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we get beyond it by doing some hard work of holding ourselves and each other accountable. When we hear the tropes of colorblind racism being expressed in conversations with friends, in the workplace, wherever it might be, you know, I think we really need to lean into those conversations and challenge ourselves and one another to be able to ask instead, well, okay, is it true that there's no racism here? The answer is almost always no, that that's not true, that there are still examples and expressions and outcomes that reflect racism throughout those systems. And to really say, okay, well, how and in what ways can we do better? You know, it's tricky because I think racism feels daunting to so many people. It's a centuries old social problem. It's one that persists even after the noble efforts of the civil rights, the freedom movement of the 1950s and the 1960s that accomplished some important things like being able to end overt discriminatory laws and things like that. And so being able to really carefully look at how this is still in play can help us come to some better solutions. I think that part of what that looks like is listening to and trusting people of color when they tell us about their experiences that may not align with our goals and our intentions in terms of wanting to have fair and equitable workplaces, you know, being able to have social interactions that don't uphold racism and other things like that. But the good news is that we all have different spheres of influence. And so there's in fact many things that each of us can do. No one of us can go out and solve the problem of racism. But if we each work within the places where we do have influence, we can collectively improve things for the better. And so I actually am hopeful about the ways that we can do that, but we have to get over colorblindness in order to do so. You know, I will just add that that I actually grew up in Battle Creek, and so I'm really excited to come to Kalamazoo. My mom went to Western Michigan, and many folks from my high school, and so you know, I have deep hometown familiarity with how some of this looks in the Kalamazoo area, and a very proud Michigan native. Get back as often as I can, and so it's really exciting for me to be able to come and have this conversation in what I think of as my home community.
We've been speaking with Dr. Megan Burke, who's an associate professor of sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University. She'll be talking about the paradox of colorblind racism at Western Michigan University on February 13th at 5:00 in Sangren Hall. Her appearance is sponsored by Western's Department of Sociology, the Lewis Walker Institute, the College of Arts and Sciences, the College of Education, the School of Communication, Lee Honors College, and last but not least, Intercultural and Anthropological Studies. Thanks so much for being with us.
I was delighted to join you. Thank you for having me.